Welcome to our podcast series, Talking with Traders, hosted by expert trader Garth McKenzie in London, from where he's interviewing various guests on the topic of trading.
Welcome to Season 2 of the Talking with Traders podcast series with me, Garth McKenzie. In this season, I'll be interviewing various successful traders and investors in my network and asking them pertinent questions about their career in the financial markets. I'll also be discussing how they've dealt with the recent surge in market volatility following the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic and how they are viewing the future as we all adjust to a new way of working. We'll also be talking about market themes that are likely to gain traction in a post-COVID-19 world. Joining me on today's Talking with Traders podcast is a man called James Gubb. James used to be a client of mine when I was a broker at BOE, brokering single stock futures. And we parted ways, I guess, James, when I left BOE in 2009 and started my own thing. And we didn't really communicate very much since then. But you became somewhat famous in the last couple of years in South Africa for something completely different. And that was the middle finger that you, your stock market art. I think it was the first stock market art that had ever been created. And you used the illiquid shares of Oak Bay Resources, the Gupta company, to create a whole bunch of trades, effectively trading against yourself at different prices. And in order to do that, created a wonderful middle finger image on the chart of Oak Bay Resources. And it was brilliant. I mean, I think everybody in South Africa was cheering you on, except the JSE, who being the JSE, didn't see the funny side of it and fined you 100,000 Rand. So that's a little bit about, you know, James Gubb and what people might recognize about you, James. And that we can talk about that in a moment. But welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Garth. Yeah, looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit, James, right to the beginning. I mean, as I said, I used to broker single stock futures at BOE. Back in those days, you were one of our clients. It was in your personal capacity that I was your broker, not in any other professional asset management capacity. But you go back a long way. You've got a long history in the market. Can you maybe take us right back to the beginning of your career and how you got involved and what sort of path your career in the market followed?
Sure. I mean, right in the early days, my father was a bit of a gold bug back in the early 70s, 73, 74, 75. And he used to chart by hand point and figure charts on these gold stocks. Now, if you cast your mind back to 75, that was the start of a really strong bull market in gold. And I was astonished at how much money one could make with virtually no effort, ostensibly, and I had a couple of penny stocks that I traded back then, straight up into 1980, and I suppose that was my technical analysis background. It was literally point and figure charts drawn on a piece of paper. Just as an aside, you've got to listen to this, Garth. My mother had an amazing trading strategy. She also did these lines on pieces of paper. And I remember her buying Anglo-American back then. And she kept a record of the chart of Anglo-American. And her discipline was, when it ended up at the end of the page, it either ended up at the top of the page or to the right of the page, she sold the share. That was her methodology, and it worked extraordinarily well. Because if it meant if the stock price went too far up, then she sold it, or if it went off the paper down, she sold it as well. It lent me. I mean, it's as simple as and mad as it sounded. It was as good a technical analysis strategy as any other.
That's actually incredible, because it is. I mean, as you said, that sometimes the most simple things actually work the best. And I guess that's it, right? Yeah. You get to the end of, if you're at the top right of the page, take some money, you've made a profit. And if it gets to the bottom right of the page, well, then clearly it's not working. Get out and take a loss and move on to the next.
I mean, I think that's quite right. I mean, all to me, I'm a bit radical on this, but I think all really technical analysis analysis does is provide a framework for approaching positions in markets. It helps mitigate risk and it instills discipline. My first job was at Allan Gray. I was their dealer, their equities dealer, together with Annette Hearn. I think she runs, I can't remember which one, Citadel, I think it is, in South Africa. And so I traded. I was also the technical analyst there for my sins. And I learned a lot from Alan himself. He was a consummate market man. And he, every lunchtime, we did nothing but discuss price trends in various stocks and commodities. It was a wonderful learning experience. I then, after that, went to Ford and Main Keys, now Ford Asset Management, and I was the PA to Dave Ford there. Then I got headhunted, went to under Paul Beachy head at Southern Asset Management. I was their dealer, then did a CFA, then became a fund manager. And then when I got taken over by RMB, joined together with a guy called Frederick Bouchard, who together we went to African Harvest Capital and launched a series of hedge funds there. Under the watchful eye of Ethan Duvey and a couple of other lenders. And then after that, when Imzi Kamala bought African Harvest, he took all the money in my hedge fund and bought African Harvest. It was, and said, right, start again. You know, here's 5 million rand. I said, no thanks. So Fred and I launched by ourselves, and we raised 1 billion rand. Quite quickly, we did very, very well, compounding at north of 40% for many years, until 08 came along. We did minus 21% in the crash. They said we weren't, you know, we should have made money and we lost it. So all the fund of funds guys got together and moved as a pack, and we lost over 70% of our assets under management. At that time, I got cancer. I got peripheral arterial disease. I was in horrible shape, and decided to call it quits and give myself a little more time and space. Ever since then, I've been trading for myself, making money, losing money, doing weird and wonderful things, but my time is my time now. And the flexibility has no price attached to it.
Well, that's right. And I have to tell the listeners this story because you're so right in what you say. So we actually had to reschedule this interview, James and I, because we were supposed to speak about 2 weeks ago, and we had it all organized. And then about 9:30 at night, my phone went, and it was from James Gubb, and the message went something along the lines of, Garth, I'm terribly sorry to do this to you. It's extremely unprofessional, but the surf is really going to be good tomorrow in Jeffreys Bay. Please, can we cancel the interview and do it another time? And and I loved it. I thought, well, that's fantastic. You know, you're doing what you love. You've worked bloody hard your whole life. You've gotten to a point where you've earned that flexibility. And I think that's what so many people strive for in their lives. And, you know, the stock markets and trading and investing ultimately can get you there if you do it right. And you've clearly done it right, and you've earned that freedom. So, you know, kudos to you and well done. And I think it's brilliant that you're living your life. And as you say, your time is your own. And things must be on your time, your terms of time, not everybody else's.
I think that's right. Talking about time, what I did, I took that advantage of the kind of infamy, I suppose, of drawing that stock chart, and it provided me a platform to actually approach the professors at Michaela School of Fine Art. This was 2 years ago, as pretext of a portfolio, an art portfolio. So, and they accepted me with a little bit of trepidation as some form of conceptual artist. So I went to Michaelis and spent full-time study at Michaelis School of Fine Art, which was an education in itself. I had to, I stuffed the average age up a lot. I shared a studio with three beautiful girls, all under the age of 23, that all had their own stories, and they were kind of somewhat aghast at this old fart arriving, but you know, I showed them a thing or two, trust me.
Well, that's fantastic. I love that story. And now the art side of things is interesting. Is that something you were into throughout your life beforehand, or is this something that you've only picked up later on in life?
No, I've always loved my art. I mean, you know, unfortunately, I had to give up art and matric to take up accounting so I could get a proper, you know, mark so I could go and do business science at UCT. But you know, I've always been interested in art. At the moment, I'm dividing my time between painting focusless fields, which is kind of like a weird way of meditation, where I use oil pastels to make marks in a kind of a meditative state. And every time I think of anything, my discipline is to move my canvas 90 degrees. So to kind of reset your mind, go back to breath, and start making marks again. So some of these canvases are rather interesting. I'm building up, now I've now got about 30 of them, and hope to have an exhibition at the end of the year. We'll see.
Okay, because, fantastic.
Yeah, it was predominantly kind of inspired by Samuel Beckett, you know, the Irish playwright, who spoke of an artist in France called André Masson, who aspired to be rid of the servitude of space so that his eye may frolic amongst focusless fields, tumultuous with incessant creation. Mm. So it's a kind of a space that you move into that, you know, anything goes, and you relax into the space by making these marks. Not focusing completely on markets has got its advantages.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I think, yeah, sometimes that time away is very, very valuable. It also helps to, you know, as you say, to refocus the mind. And I'm similar in some ways. I also took art to matric, and in fact, it was my best subject at school, but I also gave it up to study accounting and economics and get into the stock market. But the art is something I'd very much like to take up one day.
Don't mess around. Do it.
Now, just quickly, since we're talking art, let's quickly get back to that middle finger that you did on the Oak Bay share price. Now,
yeah,
it certainly made a big statement, and a statement that I think everybody that I know in South Africa thought was very much a required statement to be made about the Guptas and what they've done to the country. But obviously it got you into a little bit of hot water. You had to pay quite a hefty fine. Can you tell us a little bit about that time and just the issues you had to deal with regarding the fine and the sanctions that were held against you?
Yeah, I mean, I tell you what I was really worried about, because I'm a chartered financial analyst. The threat was from the Financial Services Board. They were going to report me to the CFA Institute and obviously take away my CFA, because I was a very naughty boy. I took it upon myself to report myself to the CFA before they did, and stated my case. And there was a month delay, and it came back and they said, this is not, it's sort of illegal because of price manipulation, etc., but you clearly didn't have a profit motive, try and refrain from making the symbolic trading activity again, which was very mature. It's exactly what should have the FSB should have done. But they didn't. They were too stupid. And that caused kind of the Streisand effect, you know, unanticipated consequences of what you think is what they thought was doing was right. And it mushroomed to the point where Bloomberg took it up worldwide. I got a full page in The Economist. I mean, you know, most companies would be, you know, green with envy to be able to get a full page in The Economist on their company. I mean, I got it, you know, for nothing. Yeah. So I got an enormous amount of notoriety, I suppose, and a good feeling as a consequence. I felt good doing it, even though it cost me $100,000.
Yeah, well, that's it. I'm sure you did feel good. And I mean, everybody was doing a big pat on the back to you for that. I thought at the time that a bunch of people had gotten together to crowdfund your 100,000 rand fine.
Yes.
Was that right?
Yes.
Or not?
That is correct. They raised, I mean, two independent people, never met them before, did a thunder fund or whatever. And I think it was 68,000 rand or 70,000 rand was raised. And I in turn handed that back to the likes of Outer and Maverick and other such entities that continue to try and fight against corruption, in South Africa.
Yes.
I also did talking about politics and stuff, in my final year at Michaelis, I did a series of pigs, sculptural pigs, that represented various corrupt companies in South Africa. It's my best stuff I've ever done. These pigs are extraordinary. Go and you can Google them on the net. Just Google my name, and you might see a few of them.
Okay.
But those were good.
Fantastic.
That stemmed from that finger.
Yeah, well, I think that finger probably got you great. As you said, it's got you the kind of marketing exposure that money couldn't buy. So, and certainly a lot more than 100,000 rand would have bought you. So absolutely brilliant.
Hundreds.
Yeah. Now, when we were talking off the recording just beforehand, you said to me that you wanted to also just discuss trading versus investing. And obviously, this is a Talking with Traders podcast. So as much as I'm loving talking about the art and all of that, we've got to try and also talk a little bit more about stock markets and what have you.
Sure.
And you said to me you've got a fairly broad or fairly specific identification of what is trading and what is investing. And there's a vast difference between the two, which I certainly agree with.
Yeah.
But tell us your perspective. What are the difference between the two?
I think it's imperative to understand the difference between investment and trading, because it leads to dramatically different strategies in trying to maximize profit. Take, for instance, the strict trading discipline of always entering a trade with a stop loss. When investing with a fundamental background, when an asset falls in price and becomes cheaper in terms of its PE ratio or price to sales or EV to EBITDA or any other fundamental statistic or rational response is to want to own more of it. One buys more as it becomes cheaper and cheaper. This implies adding to a losing position or averaging down. Which is often the exact opposite of what you should do in trading. It also implies buying into the belief that the asset will eventually return to its mean or change direction in price and start going up. You're trying, therefore, to pick a bottom. And that often flies in the face of trading strategy. There is no such thing in investment, really, as a stop loss. So there are two. Let's go a little further. It flies in the face of another classic market investment principle of. I'm going a little bit forward here. Bear with me for a second here. I'm just going to go across and try and give you an idea of what my ideal trade would be. And it would be to go long an asset from a trading perspective with a trailing stop and hold the position irrespective of how much it appreciates and how big it gets as a proportion of one's total portfolio until one is stopped out. It leads to believing strongly in my favorite market adage, it takes guts to be a greedy pig. Now, it flies in the face of another classic market investment story of the only real free lunch of traditional asset management is diversification, simply because of the fact that adding to lowly correlated assets to a portfolio adds to the risk return characteristics of a portfolio. I mean, that might well be the case, but it totally destroys the possibility of hanging on to that 10 or 20 bagger, the investment that could have made you very, very rich. So I say, do whatever you can to hold on to that winner. It takes guts because you've got so much specific risk. Some say, and generally, who are those people that say it? It's the bankers that want your com. But they say own zero cost collars if you've got that big position, you know, to try and hedge it. But I say no. If you're going to do anything, buy deep out the money puts on that position. Say 20% out the money, 30% out the money. You sacrifice 1% or 2% of your capital doing that, and then never, ever sell the upside. You'd never, ever know how a good 10 or 20 bagger hike, how high it can go. Mm. It means outlaying around 1% or 2% per annum of your value of your position, but it keeps you long, despite valuation and overweight concerns. And in fact, this kind of strategy can only really work if you manage your money yourself. Professional money managers are not allowed to do it. If a position in a mutual fund or ETF gets too big, they're forced to sell it because of position size limits. So you actually have an advantage of sorts over the pros by following the strategy. And it follows the simple trading strategy of holding your winners and folding your losers. This is quite radical, but I think the predominant way of making large amounts of money in trading is that holding on to that one idea, that one stock, and holding on to it for dear life. And it's always, you know, it's the 80-20 rule, but I think it's more 95-5 rule. It's you've got to hold on to those winners. Obviously, cutting losses, et cetera, another thing. But I think this is a way to proper investment wealth, or it certainly has been in my case.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, on this series of Talking with Traders, I've spoken to Cy Jacobs of 361 Asset Management and JP Hirster at Protea Capital Management. And, you know, in both cases, they've been very long of NASPERS, but have admitted they had to cut back the position because of exactly what you said, position size limits and risk limits and what have you. And unfortunately, doing that was disadvantageous. They could have made a great deal more money had the rules allowed them to just hold on to that position, no matter how big it got. So exactly what you say. And I guess, going back to what you said at the beginning of the interview, it's kind of following in some way the philosophy that your mum's did with her charting. As long as it's going up to the top right of the page, keep it. If it falls out the bottom of the page, well, then clearly you've got to get out and move on.
Yeah.
It's, or just add another piece of paper when it gets to the top right corner of the page and keep it.
Yeah. It's easier said than done. You know, it takes guts to be a greedy pig.
Yeah, it's a great saying that, I must say. I'm going to remember that one. Every one of these podcast interviews has got a nugget, and that's probably the nugget I'm going to take out of this one, James. But following on from that, I mean, what is your approach to risk then? Because you've alluded to it, you know, you buy deep out the money puts and whatever, but you're managing your own money now. You don't have clients. You told me you got rid of all your clients, which is a nice thing to have done, and you've got freedom on your side. But what is your approach to risk now when it comes to managing your own money? You're listening to Talking with Traders, a podcast series brought to you by IG, a world-leading online trading and investment provider. If you haven't checked out the IG online trading platform, please do so and visit IG.com. Also, make sure you subscribe to the podcast series on your favorite podcast app or website by clicking on the subscribe button, and you'll be notified weekly as we release new episodes.
You know, it obviously diversification is key. I mean, I've you know, in terms of my investable wealth, I mean, I'm working on a whole system right now that kind of a Rubik's Cube kind of analogy, but I can't talk too much about that because it's still undeveloped. But you know, your asset classes. I mean, I think you've got a. There's a. Gosh, I can't remember his name. Chris Cole, who talks about volatility being an asset class, and I think he's absolutely right. I think the 60-40 split between your traditional asset allocation between equity and bonds as a big as a big allocation kind of overlay is going to change. In fact, it is changing as we speak. So one meant to counterbalance the other, and now in our world of zero interest rates along the entire curve, that counterbalance is somewhat thwarted in bonds. So risk mitigation through bond allocation, I think, is seriously problematical in a zero interest rate environment. Mm. So what does one do then if 40% of your assets are meant to go there, or traditionally over the last 40, 50, 100 years? What does one do? And then you look at the equity side, or particularly in the developed market side, by any classical measure of value, it is extraordinarily overpriced. What are you going to invest in? The whole risk story is kind of it looks fine at the moment because markets on the equity side are still up, and the bond market's gone through a 40-year bull market, the likes of which the world has never seen. We kind of feel, it's kind of the end of, where does one go from zero? Yes, negative. Mm-hmm. I think one has to mitigate risk by looking at other asset classes. And other asset classes, I would have to include physical assets. And one of the physical assets would be gold. And I go back to, my father was a gold bug. I suppose I'm a gold bug now. I wasn't in the past. I am very significantly now, because I think it's an alternative to bonds, and it should be treated as such. On the equity front, I think obviously you need a portfolio of equities. You divide it by country, divide it by various large cap or small cap, and also divided in terms of industry. In terms of asset classes, that 60-40 split between equities and bonds, I think, has to be questioned in a negative interest rate environment, literally across the curve. If you look at bonds issued on a sovereign basis anyway, over 80% of all sovereign bonds are yielding sub 1%. I mean, that's an extraordinary stat. And so I would, as old Jim Grant says, I would consider the bond market to be return-free risk here. And you need to look at another alternative. And believe it or not, gold comes into play as a substitute, I would suggest, for the bond allocation, which was traditionally 40%. If you don't have 20% of your investable wealth in gold bullion or precious metals, I'd have to include platinum, palladium, silver in that. I think you're going to miss a trick. Going to the equity side, obviously mitigating risk is essential there. So you need a portfolio of stocks. What portfolio of stocks would I orientate myself towards? It wouldn't be towards the FANGs. I think they're too expensive. It would be towards emerging markets, because I think they're offering relatively good value compared to developed markets. And I would orientate myself towards commodities, which seem to be at around a 100-year low relative to developed stock markets. So I suppose I've got a value bias given my background. But I think you'll be well rewarded by looking at those kind of stocks. You know, I mean, getting down to specifics, the Ivanhoes, I suppose, you know, that have got, you know, absolutely top end quality ore bodies sitting there with a very smart guy at the top and very good access to capital. It's in the style of that I would allocate my capital for the next 10 years or so.
Right. Okay. That's good to hear. You did allude a bit earlier to technicals, and you spoke obviously about running profits and that. Now, I want to just try and tie that back together because I found that very, very interesting. And it's certainly something I try to do myself as well in an effort to run the profits as much as possible. But sure. Do you have a specific technical way of running a profit, I guess, because it's still for me the hardest part of trading and investing is knowing the right time to sell, because you're either going to sell too early, or alternatively you hang on and you give a large chunk of that profit back. You can talk about simple, you know, running moving averages and things like that to try and hold you in a trade, but do you have any specific technical indicator that you use to help you run profits?
It's difficult to describe it right here, Garth. It's a little more complicated than I would. You know, I can try and describe it. I have a fundamental basis. You know, I do have a fundamental basis that interests me in a particular area of the market. So, for example, a gold stock, Harmony. I think it's really, really cheap. Back a couple of years ago, it looked as though it was going bankrupt. It had potential. Could see that it wasn't going to die. So I had a fundamental bullish bias toward gold. So I had a fundamental desire to get into the stock. I had to wait for the stock to break. Obviously, breakouts, classic breakouts, were a percentage change increase in price added with volume is classic. And I waited for that. It was kind of a descending wedge back into a couple of years ago and bought it. Once you buy it, you buy as much as you can. You're 100% waiting, whatever that is in terms of your total portfolio. It might be 10%. Then I start charting it. And the way I chart it is simply to look at bar charts, daily bar charts. I try and go into hourlies, etc. You will then get whipsawed and your broker will make the money, not you. Mm. So I try and do it on a daily basis. And my absolute desire is never, ever to sell that share. So I keep my stops as wide as I possibly can stomach. My 100% position, I trade I try and draw a line, you know, a positive sloping line underneath my entry point. And I draw a parallel line, the tops on the tops and the bottoms on the bottoms. Then, if I have 100% allocation to that stock, so say it's R1 million, I've got a full allocation in on entry. If it runs up to the top end of my parallel line, touches the top parallel line, I will take profit, and I will use the commodity channel index plus a Kopok. It's just two arbitrary lines. So my Kopok, it's basically an overbought, oversold indicator, both of them. But when they start turning down, then I trade the position within the parallel band. It's kind of like Bollinger Bands, but I use simple parallel lines. And at the top of the parallel line, I've got 100%. And when it hits the bottom of the parallel line, I've got 50% long, still long. Mm. So if it gets down to the position all the way down again, and I will still hold the 50% because I've got in on a fundamental basis. So I have then and the courage on a fundamental basis, if it gets back to where it was, is to possibly add more because I've got 50%, I'm back up to 100%. So I've taken an investment decision in the beginning, and then I treat it as a trade within these parallel bands. I don't know if that makes sense to you. So if it continues further and my fundamental view then says, yeah, it's now kind of reasonable value, I will still, neither cheap nor expensive. I will still trade within my parallel lines. And if it goes to the top of the line, I will sell down to 50%. And if it goes to the bottom of the parallel line, I will generally try and add or take it up to 75%. If it breaks the parallel line and the fundamental value is in the middle, I will exit my position. Gotcha. So it's this dance is totally dedicated towards trying to hold that position forever.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. I suppose you could call it a trade vesting approach almost. So you're in it, you've got your core position, but you are trading around it to some extent, as long as it continues to perform the way that you're wanting it to. And you're obviously trying to take advantage of some of the volatility along the way.
Because markets go way beyond a fundamental valuation levels. And this is where often the meat of the move. Just look at the last tech stocks in the last 4 or 5 years. You know, you can make an absolute bloody fortune at the last bit of the bull market. You must be in it at that time. And often you'll get whipsawed, and you will get whipsawed on the way. You must be able to take a 30% bath. You must be able to do that in order to be able to get the 10 bagger in your pocket.
Yeah. To that point then, James, I mean, you and I first met obviously when I was broking futures. Futures, of course, are a leveraged product, and depending on how you utilize them, but they give you the ability to take leverage, of course. Are you trading with leverage now or not?
Yes. To a point. I mean, I look at my leverage and deleverage it and look at it in my terms of my total portfolio and see what it is. I will never ever get into a position where I'm writing options, I'm writing naked puts. I will never ever do that. I know there are particular strategies that one uses by protecting yourself if the market goes down 20 or 30%, but if it goes down 50%, which is impossible, well, then you're going to lose a lot of money. I don't like those kind of positions. In fact, I use futures going on as an aside there. I try and avoid risk as much as I possibly can. I try and avoid leverage as much as I can. But it's just convenient getting in and out of positions in the futures market. I can pick up the phone, and I can exit my position inside 5 seconds, and that's very attractive. On the stock market, it costs a little bit more, So do I use the futures market? Yeah, I still use BOE. Well, it's now Nedbank, and I trade actively there.
Okay.
Okay.
That's great. And now, James, all of us that have been around in the market for a while have a story. You've been in the market for much longer than what I have. We've all got a story or two, and I'm sure you've got many more than one or two to tell. But maybe could you tell us about your best and worst trades or best and worst investments in your career?
Oh, my God. I mean, how many? I mean, the worst ones, I've ridden a lot of stocks to zero. That's, MacMed, Legionet, I've got my badge. Oh my God. I suppose that was the bravest investment I ever made, was Dell Food. And I can't remember exactly when the hell it was. It was just bear with me here. I'll try and get my bearings. 2007, somewhere around there, it was Dell Food. It owned 10% of the world's pineapples. Okay. It was a great stock. Other was a really great stock, and it became private, and not private, it became into, I think a big Del Monte yard, bought it, and I took a very big position in it because I knew somebody like Anglo would take it out, and at some stage it might take a year or two or three, and it was incredibly cheap. So I bought a lot of it, like too much of it, and 08 came along, and it went down 85%, 90%. But they still own 10% of the world's pineapples. And I sold my house and I held Del Monte for 3 years, 4 years. And it went back plus a little bit more to the price I paid for it. Just because I had a good, strong, fundamental belief in the company, and the net asset value didn't decline, and people still ate pineapples, and they did have a dominant position in the market. That was, in retrospect, I wish I'd never done it. It most probably made me fall ill. But that was scary, but good in the end. Multiple scar wounds. You don't ever enter the stock market without lots of scars. Lots of scars.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of your best trade or best investment?
Oh, gosh. I've had 10 baggers, 15 baggers. I suppose Harmony. Harmony Warrants. If you really want an out-the-box one. Harmony Warrants. Bernie Swanepoel somehow listed. I spoke to him a while back, and he, as a consequence of that, said, "Right, well, we're going to list these Harmony Warrants," which was essentially a out-the-money call option on Harmony, trading at a significant discount to what you would have been able to purchase call options for in the derivatives market, and there was just a disconnect there. So what I did is I tended to sell those call options in the market, in the derivatives market, and on the other side, I used to buy these Harmony warrants. So they were 2 or 3 year term duration, but deep out the money, and I just odd the two, just like one versus the other for it. I was about 2 years, and I made certainly more than 1,000%.
Wow.
Yeah, so there was some lots of low-hanging fruit back in 04, 05, 06, 07, 08. It was embedded put options on, what was it, AMEC. Guys just didn't understand or look at stocks in terms of a composite of options and yield. It was a beautiful time.
Yeah. Wonderful. Now, as we head towards the end of the interview, James, if somebody, a youngster, came to you now and said, "Well, I want to get involved in the stock market. I want to become a fund manager or a trader, and this is what I want to do for my career," what, two or three pieces of advice would you give to them?
I'd say don't. I really believe that. I've got twin daughters. They're 28 years old, and both of them say, "We're going to do the stock market." And I said, "Don't." I'm sorry. I'm going to ruin this whole interview, but I said, get into tech, because tech is going to disintermediate asset management. And through digitization of the general core competencies of asset managers, and I think this is coming to the fore. On the trading side, AI is making a massive inroads into trading profits. So if I was to give advice to young people to go and play stock markets, I would say go and buy companies that are AI based that go and trade stock markets. I think we are in the process of being disintermediated by AI. I firmly believe that. Mm. 85% or something of all trades now are not made by humans.
It says something.
Do you not, just on that point, I mean, do you not feel that the basic laws of supply and demand are still as applicable as they always were? And it's just that there's some sort of automatic machine putting the orders in now, as opposed to a human being?
No, not really. I mean, I'm looking at these algorithms can decipher central bank statements quicker than you and I can, and are generally and put their orders in way before we can. They might be right or wrong in the end. It's possible. But you're fighting against something that is quicker than you, it's faster than you, and in some ways more intelligent than you. You have biases that you've got to constantly fight. You've got to fight discipline. You've got to, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Yes, you know, the guys make the machines and you tell the machines what to do and garbage in and garbage out and you know, all that kind of stuff. But I also look at how money is made at the moment, and money is not allocated necessarily on what we call fundamentals anymore. It's based on flow. It's based on percentages in passive index funds. It doesn't have the logic that we have been dependent on over the last 80 or 100 years, you know, classic Graham and Dodd stuff. So I'm a little disillusioned here. How would I tell a person to approach markets now? I would have far, far more confidence in getting into the tech space. I really would. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry to say that, Garth, but that's what I think.
Yeah, no, but that's what I wanted, honesty, and that's what you're giving us. So thank you. Last question then, James, before we sign off. Are there any books that spring to mind immediately that you would recommend people read when it comes to stock market investing?
Just top of my head, just go and do Market Wizards. Gives you lots of inspiration. Market Wizards 2, just as, what have I loved? Yeah, I really enjoyed Market Wizards. They might be a bit old now.
I think they're good. I mean, I loved Market Wizards as well. And he actually keeps on bringing out new ones now. So there's Market Wizards.
And then, it sounds so boring. But go and read Buffett's letters. They're free, and they are extraordinary.
Yeah.
Go and get a Precy, and you can Google on it, and it'll give you the last 100 years and just the best bits of the last 100 years, or not 100, but I mean, you know, the last 50 years of Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah.
That would be kind of number one reading for me.
It's funny, a number of the guests on these podcasts have actually said exactly that. Go and just download Warren Buffett's letters. They're free and you can read them, and they've got more insight than you're going to get anywhere else. So
I would agree.
Yeah, good insight that. Okay, James, I'm going to have to wrap it up there. It's been really interesting talking to you. I thoroughly enjoyed it and listening to your story. And I love the fact that you've got such freedom in your life now and you're pursuing art and surfing and doing all the things that one does when you've done well and you've had a good career. And congratulations.
Yeah. I mean,
it's been nice catching up.
Thanks, Garth. You too, man. Good luck, my mate.
Yeah. Okay. Take care. Cheers.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to the series by clicking the subscribe button on your favorite app. Till next time.